Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hello and welcome to Friday, the show where we interview friends and interesting people to the backdrop of great music. Today we are joined by Corey Brettschneider, who has written the book Keep Oath and The Office. Hello Corey, how are you, geez?
I'm terrific, thank you. Thanks for having me and looking forward to this conversation, great deal.
I got this big book sent to the post.
Okay.
From your people. It's a weighty tome. How do you go about putting together such a book? And then here's a provocative question for you. Do
sure.
you need another book about the office of the presidency?
I guess the history of the book might answer the deeper question as well.
Mm-hmm.
When President Trump began to run for president and was making a series of proposals, I wrote a piece for Politico with the title Trump versus the Constitution, a Guide. And the idea was to really go through piece by piece what he was saying and proposing and explaining why it wasn't just a violation of the Constitution, the things that he was proposing. So things like the commitment to shut down all Muslim immigration to the United States, the proposal to torture the families of suspected terrorists, not just the suspected terrorists themselves. And the idea was to go proposal by proposal and explain clause by clause why this was a violation of the Constitution. But the point was more than that. It was to suggest that this was somebody in his disposition, not just in his proposals, that was really hostile to the very idea of the office, the idea of the oath of office, which, after all, is a commitment to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. So I think a lot of people pointed out why he was immoral, why he wasn't a great leader. But I guess at least at the time, this was, I think, one of the first pieces, at least, to really dissect why it was a violation of the Constitution. And I guess I think the other deeper point is that, you know, even though that sort of language is there in the first second in office, preserve, protect, mm-hmm. and defend the Constitution, that isn't really the way that we talk about modern presidents. And if you look at most presidential historians, if you look at what people say about presidencies and evaluating them, I don't think that the usual thing is to put the Constitution first. And yet that is supposed to be the definition of what it means to faithfully respect the office.
Do you think the average American is really au fait with the nuance, not the tenets, but with the nuance of the American Constitution? Or are they just American? I'm going to phrase that a little
sure.
bit better, or I'm going to expand on my point.
Sure.
So this is a conversation which I frequently have with Americans, and I talk
right.
about how exceptional America is. And
right.
no Brit is au fait with any bit of the British Constitution, because technically speaking, we don't have one.
Right.
You're just British. No German
right.
is au fait with the German Constitution. You're just German. No Italian.
Right.
No, you know, the amount of countries throughout the world that have a constitution which defines nationality, you can literally count on the fingers of one hand.
Mm.
You're just Brazilian. You don't have to believe in the tenets of the constitution. And for me, somebody like President Trump is just an exemplar of that. He's just, in a way, he's denying American exceptionalism. He's just saying America is just like anywhere else in the world. If you're Canadian, you're just Canadian. To hell with the nuance of the Constitution, with the oath of office. We're just Americans, and in a way, that's
right.
incredibly normal. Looked at the whole world over.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are aspects of the exceptional parts of American constitutionalism that I that are problematic, and some that I want to defend. And to me, the main benefit that I think actually the rest of the world should learn from is the idea that you're not American based on ethnicity, based on blood. And the idea in particular that he has recently proposed getting rid of, that if you're born in this country, you are an American, regardless of whether your parents were here legally, illegally, whether you're here multiple generations or just for a few minutes. That, to me, goes to the core of the American constitutional creed, which is about equal protection of the law, that we don't, and this is the break from monarchy, that we don't have a system of blood status, that we reject the idea that who your parents are define your rights in any way. And those are things actually that to me are fundamental to the idea, not just of American constitutionalism, but democracy, and that really you are missing in parts of the world where you could be four generations within the borders of a country and yet not have citizenship. And so I think that his racism and his anti-constitutionalism sort of fit together in a way that I find it deeply problematic. I mean, the ideal of the office, the way, you know, George Washington understood it, for instance, or Madison, the early republic, isn't just that the Constitution's a set of laws, but it's that it's a set of values. And those are the values that I very much want to defend, primarily the value of equal protection enshrined in the 14th Amendment, but certainly present before that in the Declaration of Independence. The idea that you can criticize a president, that this isn't an office that sort of attaches to the to a kind of immunity from criticism, the idea of religious freedom, all of these things that are in many ways exceptional, so I agree with that, are to me great, not just a problem. And they define the office as well. You know, the idea of a presidency really is, if America is exceptional in its constitutional protections, well, then the office of presidency is unique too, and the commitment, I think, to honor those specific things. So, you know, sometimes American exceptionalism means, you know, a sort of entitlement to grandiosity, to try to lead the world in military affairs. That's not the version of it that I want. But the idea that we protect all forms of free speech, or that we don't have an established religion, or that we're equal at birth, that I very much do want to defend and see a president.
Corey, let's try and unpick some of those points you've laid out there. First off, it's called The Oath and the Office, your book. So the oath is obviously something which you see as incredibly central to the role of the president. It's his promise, his pledge to the nation. Why is Washington's second inaugural? Why is that so important? Obviously, it was, you know, one of the shortest. It was only 135 words. why is this viewed in stark contrast to the one that came before?
I mean, I think you find it in the first inaugural too, but the second really does it in the best possible way. It puts the focus on the idea that the person, the man, George Washington, is not the office, and that the office in many ways is above whoever occupies it at any particular time. The office is defined by the need to respect the rights enshrined in the Constitution. And what he says in that second inaugural is that if I, George Washington, fail to respect the oath that I just took, subject me to constitutional punishment. And to me, you know, it sort of enshrines the modesty of the office, that this is a commitment to do a job, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution specifically. And if you fall short of that, or if you violate it in an extreme way, then the result isn't, it's not like a monarch who just gets away with it and continues to act how they want. It's remove me, subject me to constitutional punishment, impeach me, remove me. And I think too, that what he's hinting at, although it's not clear exactly from the text, is that a president is not above the law and can be subject to criminal indictment, despite the arguments that you sometimes hear claiming that the president has a special sort of immunity from that, that obligation.
You know, I always find it kind of fascinating being a Brit, looking at early American history and that period where you guys are defining your system of government and your ideals and your values. And it always strikes me that you guys overplay the position of King George III. No, it's not that he wasn't so bad. He actually wasn't so powerful. He wasn't really directing British policy. It was it was the government of the day. It was North et al. It was all of those guys.
Right.
And actually, if you were to look at continental Europe in 1776, 83, 1789, and you'd have said, which is the most open government? Good dog. What dog do you have?
So sorry. He's a Havapoo. Bailey is making an appearance on 10 Presidents.
Well, it's the first dog actually to bark an answer. So taking great offense to where I was heading with my question.
In particular, it was the defense of George III that he just instinctively, as a now full-fledged American, does not appreciate. But no, I take the point, which is there was a form of parliamentary constraint already happening in England. And I think one of the best new books making that argument is a book by Harvard professor Eric Nelson, who makes exactly that point, that, you know, the idea of the constraints of the office were present already in England and in British parliamentary, democracy.
It goes back to the Glorious Revolution a century before. It goes back to the restoration of the monarchy after Charles the First, after after his execution. And kind of interesting for me is looking back at Jefferson and Franklin, who both traveled to the UK. Traveled to England and took great solace in terms of the limits that were put on the executive, on the British executive when they were still British subjects, and look back at the Glorious Revolution as this kind of font of American liberty.
Right. So I guess
overplay this all the time. You know, a monarch with a nice shiny hat on their head is not such a bad thing.
Well, I guess I would say this. On the one hand, it's certainly true that the idea of constitutional constraints on the president, on any state actor, has its origin in the idea of the balance of power between the parliament and King George III and other British monarchs. But I do think there is a break. And so I think part company with Nelson and others who really push that point in the following way. The American Revolution is about equality and the notion of the rejection of royalty and the notion of status distinctions at all based on birth and even what you might think of as symbolic distinctions. And let's take, for instance, the benign establishment of the Church of England. That's rejected out of hand by Madison and then enshrined into law in our First Amendment, the ban on the establishment of religion. And I don't think that symbols are irrelevant to the American creed or doctrine that comes after it. So that idea that you're a citizen if you're born here, for instance, the rejection of both symbols but also funding for church institutions, those are fundamental not only to the break with England but to the ongoing way that America defines, constitutional democracy and equality. And those aren't, to me, just Corey, symbols. Yeah, sorry.
Corey, I'm always struck by the power of the symbol and by the intellectual force of the argument of, you know, Madison striking down his two bills.
Right, exactly.
You know, so religion could not be established in the States. And obviously that was a key Jeffersonian credo.
Yes.
You know, that he said, no, we're not going to have an established religion over here.
Correct.
My country, and I don't do a compare and contrast all the time, but it is the country that I know the most, my country being the United Kingdom.
Right.
And we don't have an established, a disestablished church. The Queen, our head of state, is the supreme head of the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter.
Benign. Yeah.
How many British prime ministers run for office and have to say that they are a Christian? Absolute zero. And actually the ones that do feel a little bit odd. And I compare and contrast that with your president, who so obviously has hardly ever stepped a foot in church in his life, but to run for office had to have this mock mini conversion and had to pretend, you know, he went to a couple of black churches and pretended to mouth along to songs and what to hymns. and very obviously, this man doesn't have a Christian bone in his body. And I don't think that that's important for him to execute the office, but it's important to you Americans. And at the heart of your American experiment, which has gone pretty well for you so far, don't get me wrong.
We're having a little trouble these days.
Well, maybe it's just a stress test. And one of the many stress tests is your book, you know, to, just to remind Americans of the reason why they separated all those years ago from the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
But you maybe in 2019 can conceive of somebody running for office, the highest office in the land, and saying that they are not a regular churchgoer, they're not a practicing Christian. You can conceive of it now. You couldn't before.
Yes, and I guess, you know, I don't want to state the book. The book certainly does speak about this break with monarchy that many, not all, but many of the framers thought were essential. But I guess I think the comparison or the use of it isn't necessarily in saying that this regime is better than the British one, which of course we're drawing so much strength from and influence both in our common law and the structure of limited government. It's sort of the use of it is internally in American politics, because we, maybe more so than the history of the UK, have a deeply anti-democratic, anti-rule of law strand that we have to combat. And so alongside the ban on religious establishment is a strong belief ongoing, certainly now getting stronger, that this is a Christian nation. Or along our tradition of free speech, we have many leaders, the current one among them, who want to ban criticism of the government. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, has proposed perhaps shutting down Saturday Night Live, the show that criticizes him and that he evidently watches. And so that's the use of it, I think. It's not necessarily in showing an improvement over countries whose history and whose norms are sort of fit the constitutional tradition. It's in using it internally against opponents that have always really been here. I mean, in the 19th century, of course, we have the tradition of slavery that's eventually ended with the Equal Protection Clause, and then a system of apartheid in a big part of the country. Now, what's the use? What's the way of sort of getting rid of this? We can't just rely on norms and history dating back to the 18th century. It's this legal tradition that kind of stands above. So I think, you know, I wouldn't want to compare the U.S. and say in any way that our system or our history is better than the U.K., you know, but I do think that its use is in fighting opponents of liberal democracy, of constitutional democracy at home.
So we have, to draw a strand from what you just said, you have a president who seems to instinctively not understand that criticism of him, his policies, is a key part of democracy. It's a key part of the functioning heft of America. I'm trying to think of a better way to say this. But
yes,
very much at the start of the Republic, you had Adams.
Right.
And his Alien and Seditions Act. So why don't you wind us all the way back to the late 18th century? Set the scene for us. Why did the second president sign into law this act? And where has this act actually gone? And what does it tell us about America at that time?
Yes. I mean, as I talk about in the book, there have been moments in American history. Donald Trump is by no means the first president to disregard the oath. There have been others who have been as bad, certainly. And one example is the second president, John Adams, who, rather than take the idea of the office seriously, including the notion of putting the law before oneself, and in particular, the right to criticize the president, does the inverse. And he signs into law these acts, including a sedition act, the Alien Acts, which are discrimination acts, basically, against those not deemed sufficiently American, those coming from elsewhere. But I focus in on the Sedition Act in particular, which makes it a crime to criticize the president of the United States. And just to show you what's going on with the structure of this, how partisan this legislation is, of course, the vice president at the time, Thomas Jefferson, is a member of a different party than Adams. Adams is a Federalist and Jefferson a Democratic Republican. And what the law says is you can criticize the president, but not the vice. You can't criticize the president, but you can criticize the vice president of the United States. It's, in other words, a pure power grab by the Federalists. And also it fits with Adams' understanding of himself as monarch-like. I think he really doesn't buy the idea of the break with monarchy at all. And he sees himself as entitled to a certain kind of dignity that means that he can't be subject to criticism. And not only that, but he also orders his attorney general to go after political opponents. In the book, I talk about Matthew Leon, the congressman from Vermont, who is actually in prison for mocking Adams. Newspaper editors are put in jail. And so to me, that has a, maybe it doesn't reflect the power of George III, but it certainly harkens back to a time of British monarchy where there was a crime of sedition that could result in pure punishment. And that is so roundly repudiated by the election of 1800, by Jefferson and Madison and their resistance to the Alien Sedition Acts, their use of the states to proclaim the acts unconstitutional, and ultimately of the American people to vote out of office the second president. So it's a symbol of, yes, early failings, early violation of the oath of office, but also a reminder of what the creed is supposed to be, that a president should be subject to criticism and should welcome it, not oppose it.
So the presidency John Adams is over in 1800, and that election is seen as one of the dirtiest in American history, with all manner of pot shots taken at candidates. Was it really clear back then? I know you kind of said in your answer that the president was, Adams wanted the president to be above naked criticism. But how easy was that going to be to switch off the kind of the vitriol from somebody who's running as a candidate and saying that they were sleeping with their slaves and they were, Scottish bastards and whatever, like as Hamilton was accused to be, etc. Then all of a sudden they're elevated into the presidency. How ideologically could that switch actually be made?
I think, presidential campaigns are often very vicious and involve all manner of speaking. But to me, the difference in what Adams did as opposed to what goes on during a campaign is that he tried to enshrine into law, not tried to, he did enshrine into law with the help of his party, a rule which said you can't criticize the president, and if you do it, you go to jail. And that is different than using speech in a vicious way, attacking opponents. Mm-hmm. And it really is antithetical to the consensus. And this is not a partisan view. There is no disagreement on the current Supreme Court. This would be a 9-0 case that the Alien and Sedition Acts are clearly unconstitutional. Our First Amendment protects all views, and especially criticizing the president. So, yeah, he was a real failure.
Okay. But don't you feel that you've been a little bit hard on Adams? Because he needed to get this through Congress and get it through the Senate. He wasn't the only person in America that kind of had this view, was he?
No. I mean, and, again, the American experiment is new. The Bill of Rights and its First Amendment is only passed in the first Congress. So it's very fresh. But it was an early... talk about a stress test. It was an early stress test, an early question of whether or not we were going to honor the basic requirements of that right. And he, with the aid of his own party in all branches, so it was really a partisan piece of legislation passed without support from the other party, his allies in Congress, the Federalists, and let's not forget, too, the Supreme Court, including Samuel Chase, who's supposed to be an independent justice, is the chief advocate or one of the chief advocates for this piece of legislation. I know a lot of times historians try to be balanced, but I'm a constitutional lawyer, a person who is a defender of the document and who's evaluating presidents based on how well they uphold it. And so Adams, to me, I know he has his defenders. He was a very learned person, one of the most prominent lawyers to legal minds to hold the office, up there with Wilson. But like Wilson, who also flouted the office in similar way, a Democrat president in the early 20th century, Adams really threatened the Republic, I think. And this election, as vicious as it was, the fact that the acts expire and really don't come back, except for a brief period of time in the early 20th century, that matters to the development of American democracy. Because to me, I should say this too, and this is different from a European perspective in some ways, I don't think you can have true democracy and have limits on free speech, especially when it comes to criticism of leaders.
It's a good job you put in that little qualifier at the end, because there are many limits, many
yes,
is wrong.
Yes,
there
of
are
course,
there are yeah. limits on free speech in the UK. And I don't think any Brit would say that they feel any less free than an American. We don't look to America and say, "Oh my God, these guys are free." There is a legal limit on race hate speech in the UK. Like, there are certain things you cannot say, which are things which you can say in the UK, sorry, in the US. But then, of course, there is the whole analogy of, shouting fire in a cinema type of thing. But anyway,
right.
You mentioned
it's criticism of leaders in particular, I guess, that I'm concerned about in the early Republic. That's what Adams tried to do and didn't get away with. And I think if you don't have that protection, the ability to say to the president of the United States, "You're doing a terrible job," or even to mock the president, that I don't see how our system really can slip from a democratic form of government to a different kind. And I don't think Adams himself has a constitutional view of American democracy. He's got something that verges more on what's called the bad form of monarchy.
Again, it's just kind of fascinating for me to do this. I'm doing all the things which I keep on saying I'm not going to do. I'm not going to do a compare and contrast. I'm not going to do a compare and contrast. And that's exactly what I'm reaching for. James Gilroy was a famous British caricaturist and kind of printmaker in roughly this period. No, not in roughly, exactly this period. And he mercilessly mocked in cartoon and caricature not only British prime ministers, but also the monarch.
Yeah.
And I suppose at the heart of my fascination with your country and its constitution and its set of norms is the belief that you think that everything that you guys do is absolutely exceptional. And we have this really famous cartoonist lampooning the king, the head of state, the head of the executive, the prime ministers all the time. And he wasn't thrown in prison. But I want to move on from.
Can I say just one last comment about it? I mean, I guess I think, there are traditions that have free speech respected, but without a legal guarantee of it, I think at least in this country, and I don't want to claim this is true of other countries with maybe a more of a stronger historic democratic tradition, I worry that there are continually forces that would move in the direction of not respecting through norms free speech. And so, the legal protection, I guess, in American politics is a sort of bolstering. And, this president, I'm sorry to bring it back to the present, is an example of that. I think left to his own devices without a guarantee of a court, for instance, that would stop this immediately, and he's being told that, we might be in a position where we are very far from tolerating criticism of our leaders. So, yeah, I think the legalistic thing here protects us in a way that might not be necessary in other countries with, let's call it a stronger set of norms.
So let's move on from the late 18th century, the early 19th century, to the early 20th century. And you kind of pushed us in the direction of Wilson, a president who you said kind of brought to the office not only the bully pulpit, but an obligation to uphold the oath. Here's my thinking on this, right? And I haven't written a weighty tome which literally needed two UPS vans to deliver it to my house. So right, you've written the big book and you've done all the research.
It's only 60,000 words. Which one did they send you? You might have gotten the Adam's Complete Works or something.
it had your name on it, sir, and with an orange cover. So I'm guessing it was your book, but maybe the print, the type was very big, hence all the pages.
It did have some good stories in it too, right?
Listen, I took it to bed with me most nights, had a very good time with it, had a very good read with it. So I thank you for that.
Okay, thank you.
Before we come on to the obligation to uphold the oath.
Yes.
So you say that Wilson expands the presidency and he kind of gives a constitutional argument for the notion that the president is the first amongst equals.
Right.
If you take kind of the traditional view of the American presidency, the imperial presidency kind of starts with Theodore Roosevelt, doesn't it? That he seems to galvanize a force of personality.
Yes.
And other kind of constitutional norms to remodel the American presidency. And is really what we're talking about there, which you kind of say that Wilson is a really good example of this. You know, he's the first among equals. Is this really because of new technology? Because it's not by accident, is it, that by the time we get to Theodore Roosevelt, we can hear the voices of presidents. They were on acetate, they were on vinyl. It was the start of radio, okay, a little bit after Wilson maybe. This is a time of near universal literacy, so that people could read newspapers. So is this consolidation of presidential power really just a natural concurrence to do with modern technology, modern communication technologies, or is this some kind of redefining, slight withering of the Constitution and the office of the presidency?
Yeah, I think it's a convergence of forces. I certainly wouldn't discount everything that you said. I think that's an important part of it. And especially since the way that the power is consolidated by Theodore Roosevelt and sort of solidified by Wilson is speech. There's sort of a tradition about how presidents are going to conduct themselves. And the notion in particular, you see this in those Washington speeches that I'm talking about. He's really addressing himself to Congress and talking about what he owes Congress, and that bit about constitutional punishment is him saying, you know, to the House, really, if I violate the oath, you know, you have a mechanism to do something about it, which is subject me to constitutional punishment, that second inaugural. And I think the difference that corresponds to the technological creation that you're talking about is no longer am I going to talk to the other branches. I'm going to talk to the American people, and I'm going to galvanize them to back my pieces of legislation, whether it's in the Roosevelt case about, safety of things like food and or later with Wilson, things like the argument, the unsuccessful argument for the League of Nations. But it's that I think that is a sort of difference in constitutional approach between I'm going to work with Congress to pass bills. I'm going to, you know, either be equal or maybe even slightly subservient to the will of Congress, which is the lawmaking body. So, no, I'm really going to step out in front and use this technology to create an independent kind of power. And I think what makes Wilson different from Roosevelt is that he is, you know, teaching constitutional law at Princeton. He is certainly one of the preeminent constitutional law scholars in the country.
So he should have known better.
It. He should have. He did know better, I think. And he's also, you know, I guess I'm also not naive in the sense that I admire Washington, of course, but I don't think we're going to go back to a president not speaking to the nation or subsuming his or herself to Congress. But it's the convergence of that beginning of the imperial presidency with the racism of Wilson and really the outright arrogance of, it's not just racism, it's celebrating the Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, there are historians, I've seen a lot of popular historians, for instance, trying to underplay the fact that he shows Birth of a Nation in the White House. And they say, you know, he didn't really know what was in it. He shows it and it's not a big deal. It's not really him defending racism in the office. And I just think that's false. As I say in the book, the film quotes him twice at length from his own work celebrating the Klan and its racism. And then that corresponds to actions that he takes within the executive power to resegregate, for instance, the federal workforce. So it isn't a sort of by the way thing. And it isn't that he's unaware of Justice Harlan's dissent, for instance, in Plessy versus Ferguson, saying that we truly have a colorblind constitution. It's that he's actively choosing to support the extreme right, the view of the Ku Klux Klan. And he's really converging the danger of the newfound powers of the president with forces that are really against the equal protection guarantee that all Americans are supposed to have regardless of race. And that's why he really is, to me, a symbol of a dangerous and in many ways failed president.
So we've just had the State of the Union address, where we have this incredibly, at least by American standards anyway, incredibly diverse intake of new congressmen and women. And all of the Democratic women were wearing white to in recognition of 100 years of women's suffrage. That was implemented by Wilson, wasn't it? You know, can we, should we damn this man who was, I think we can say, by the standards of 2019, a racist, somebody who systematically tried to block and to get rid of any black federal employees. But can we completely throw away the fact that under his administration, women were given the vote? He was somebody who tried to prevent World War II by having the League of Nations, you know, a very far-sighted president in many ways.
Yes, yeah, and I think, you know, we've got to tolerate the ambiguity, certainly. I agree with all of those things. I mean, women's suffrage, he gets some credit, but of course there's a movement behind it that he's not getting in the way of. So I don't know how much credit he gets for that counterbalances. But, you know, I guess I would add to the criticism of him, to the concern about that we're talking about race. And, you know, exactly as you put it, he is by far and away a racist for his time. Celebrating the Klan is not the norm of American politics. It's still, even at that period of time, the version of right-wing racism, that, you know, is rejected by much of the country. But the other thing is the Adams-like quality of him. You know, this is also a time of the Red Scare and, you know, permissive Supreme Court. And, you know, he supports the prosecution of people running for office who he deems too left. And so that's another big minus in my book. But yes, I take your point, too, that, you know, He sort of creates in many ways the modern presidency, and there are things that we can praise him for as well. What I guess one thing I will point out that I think is different from my approach than many historians is, to me, in evaluating a president, the thing that comes first is the minimum requirement is, did they respect the oath? And so that's why he fails in a way that he might not if you have other criteria, for instance, you know, how powerful was he? Mm-hmm.
Corey, I think we need to take five away from all this presidential chat, because normally on Friday 15 or Friday, as I now call it, because these interviews are much more longer than 15 minutes. I try and glean a little bit about the person I'm speaking to by their music choices. So this is your time to shine, sir. tell us the piece of music that you've nominated for the show this week.
I chose The Clash, Know Your Rights.
As always, here is an American constitutional scholar, and you've reached for a British example, haven't you? You know, why have we gone for The Clash?
I just partly to, given our conversation and the challenge that we owe it all to England, that was tempting, but also because the content of the song, to me, even though it sort of fits perfectly, it certainly comes from England, but it perfectly captures, I think, the American approach to the presidency, which is that, yes, a president is a powerful figure, the kind of symbol and leader of American government in many ways, but also limited in his or her power, and has to respect the idea that the sovereignty of the people is really where that power is grounded. And that's what The Clash are saying, you know, in the end, it's up to the people to claim their rights, to know them, to articulate them. And what better way of merging the conversation that we had about the origin of these ideas in British parliamentary democracy, and also the both the debt that we owe to England, but the way in which maybe we have, oh, now I'm going to really push it, more perfectly perfected some of these ideas.
Hey, 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 hey.
This is a public service announcement with guitar. Know your rights. Oh, three of them. Number one, you have the right not to be killed. Murder is a crime. Unless it was done by a policeman or an aristocrat. Threats. Oh, know your rights. And number two, you have the right to food money. We'll be right back.
But doesn't this wonderful piece of music just illustrate how much you lost by separating from the British crown? Good old-fashioned English kind of punk ska. You know, you don't get things more rough and ready, but also meaningful than that, do you?
I mean, I just, you know, I highly respect this band. It has a sort of bluntness to it. It's got a message. It's amazing to listen to. And yeah, it's a kind of rawness. It also is the least pretentious band of all times. And, you know, part of what I've been trying to push is the idea that the American Revolution was a sort of rebellion from aristocracy, that the egalitarian ideas of the American Revolution are just anything but pretentious. And what better illustration of that than this sort of really earthy, you know, real, authentic sound from The Clash.
But wasn't Joe Strummer a little bit of an aristocrat amongst punks? You know, he was kind of a punk royalty almost.
Yeah. The idea, I see, yeah. I mean, but I don't know, if there's a such thing as punk royalty, I think it's pretty different from the idea of the pretension of the true aristocracy. I don't think of the message of The Clash in any way being about some being better than others due to birth. I mean, maybe a recognition of within a system of equality that some of us are better lyricists than others. I think that's fine. But the point of the lyrics is to bring out the message of quality, of the power of people to limit government and to demand what they're owed.
Just before we leave The Clash, you know, with your present president in mind, surely the song you should have picked is Should I Stay or Should I Go?
I love it. Definitely. And you know my view. The answer to that song is yes, you should go, Mr. President.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Okay. One of the powers of the presidency is the idea that if there is an emergency, he has extrajudicial powers.
Well, that's not in our constitution, in my understanding anyway. There's a debate about it, I guess I would say.
Okay. Well, let's let's go to the example that you use.
Yeah.
Which is the one which is always cited, which is Youngstown,
right. Yes,
and,
exactly.
Against Truman, and then
right.
Expand on the argument, because obviously this is extremely right. prescient right now, and even
yes.
though
yes.
as we sit here in early February, it looks like President Trump will not call a national emergency. There is the question of, is this constitutional, etc. So let's deal with the example in 1952, and then
yes.
let's talk about the academic argument as to whether the president can or should actually enforce emergency powers.
Yes, exactly. Great. I would say that certainly there are people who believe that the Constitution enables the president in an emergency to act during wartime, for instance, in a way that otherwise, in normal periods of time, a president couldn't act. To me, the best refutation of the idea that the president has inherent emergency powers is found in the Youngstown case, in the main opinion, but also in the concurrence by Justice Jackson, who had been the American prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials. And what Jackson says in that opinion is that unlike the Weimar Constitution, for instance, that the American Constitution has no, and certainly he's right textually, no textually granted emergency powers. And he says, really, it doesn't have inherent emergency powers at all. And in wartime or in peacetime, the president's power is at its lowest point when Congress says that a president can't act. So in that case, let's just explain what happened to the listeners, for those who don't know it. President Truman decides during the Korean War that steel production is not as strong as it needs to be. And when there is a strike in these steel mills throughout the country, he says, I need to use my emergency powers through executive order to take over these mills, to stop the strike, and to get steel production going. And in this Supreme Court opinion, the question is, does the president have these wartime emergency powers? And the answer is no, because Congress considered granting him these powers and then explicitly and implicitly decided to deny them. And the main opinion, the opinion by Jackson, says, you know, sorry, Mr. Truman, you know, this is far from Hitler or the takeover of a country by a fascist regime. I mean, Jackson had worked for Truman and was in many ways a fan, but also wanted to lay down this idea that a president is constrained by the law, even in a plausibly, in that case, in an emergency. I mean, it wasn't that he was making this up about steel production. So when we go to the present time, to me, you know, certainly a constitutional argument for emergency powers is dubious. And I think, too, the opinion still is the law of the land. And we have to look to whether or not Congress has allowed for the building of the wall or not, or prohibited it. And, my, you know, there's an argument that there are statutes passed since Youngstown that do grant this president power to do that, not based in the Constitution, but based in statutory law. And an Emergency Powers Act, for instance, passed in the 1970s. But the better of the argument to me is still that Youngstown argument. The Congress considered granting this ability to build the wall and decided not to.
Mm. So one of the things which I kind of found really, really interesting in your book, and was kind of crystallized into one of your points, and we kind of mentioned this before, at least I did anyway, was kind of the hiring and firing.
Mm.
And it's something which you say that Wilson and FDR did so at will. And specifically to do with Wilson's reputation has really taken a tumble. In the time that I went to school, we learnt about the First World War. He was always seen as not quite the great liberator, because you Americans just swanned in at the last minute and just had a couple of battles, but you were seen as a breath of fresh air in those peace negotiations, and really that was Wilson, wasn't it? This was a new way of looking at the world. We had this massive cataclysm.
Yes.
Which had bestrode the planet, or in Europe anyway. And here is somebody with bold new ideas, and people kind of rallied to that. And that was definitely the what I read in those history books in the 1980s when I was at secondary school, or high school, as you'd call it, in America. And his reputation has massively taken a tumble since. Not only because of his kind of quite naked kind of racist attitudes, but explain to us how the oath and the, you know, the pledge to the nation protects civil servants and then independent prosecutors, etc. Again, as a Brit, I say, well, we kind of have this, and Theresa May doesn't put a hand on a Bible and have this oath. Right. And we have a functioning civil service, which is independent from the executive. And I'm guessing the French, the Spanish, the Germans, the Italians kind of say the same. And I appreciate that those countries have a very different 20th century history when it comes to civil governance. But, you know, they've arrived at a place which I don't think is going to be that too different from the United States. So okay, so tell me why Wilson and FDR were bad, what they did, and how because of the oath in office, how that has prevented the executive carte blanche just putting its friends in crony positions.
First, I should say, I wanted to say something about Wilson, and I had a similar sort of trajectory with him where I was a graduate student at Princeton, where he was revered and taught as the internationalist. Many things are named after him. I was actually very proud to be married in the former house that he lived in. And so I've learned all this since. So I also am with you in having a big tumble from being a big fan to being a skeptic. The other place where he, I don't know if this, I would condemn him in the way that I would for the speech and the racism, the failure to respect free speech and his racism. It's a more nuanced area, but it's an important one. And it's one in which I think the Constitution in many ways and its setup might make us more vulnerable to the United States, more vulnerable to manipulation by a bad president than many European countries, where there is a kind of tradition of protecting the civil service. And the argument that Wilson makes, basically there's a postmaster general that he wants to fire, and he's supposed to get consent according to the law at the time of the Senate if he wants to be able to fire this civil servant, a way of protecting civil servants. And, you know, there's a long history of laws protecting civil servants. But he says, I'm the president of the United States. It's part of this move to the imperial presidency. And I have the right as president to fire my employees. And these members of the executive branch, including the postmaster general, are my employees. And the Supreme Court agrees with them. The sort of master constitutional argument, you know, he directs. He carries out this firing, the Supreme Court agrees with him. Now, the danger of that precedent...
So he wasn't wrong then, was he, Corey?
I don't think that's the danger, that one move, but now here, moving up to FDR and the modern point, the extreme version of the Wilsonian argument, and I don't think that necessarily he had this in mind, but this is where it could be taken, would say that all civil servants are subject to the firing by the President of the United States at will and for any reason. And you see where this starts to be a danger when the civil servants are the ones who are in charge of investigating wrongdoing within the executive branch. And so after Watergate, you know, the decision is made to create an office where if the president or people close to the president are accused of criminal acts, suspected of criminal acts, that they are immune from firing by a president who wants to just protect him or herself. And the thought was, you know, Nixon was in this position where Nixon had you know, fired essentially an attorney general, his cabinet official, who refused to fire the person who was looking into his possible crimes. So Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, refuses to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor at the time. So Nixon just fires Richardson and then fires the deputy who takes over until Mr. Bork, later Judge Bork, takes that office and agrees to fire Cox. Now, after that, the thought was, you know, maybe this has gotten out of hand, the Wilsonian idea that the president can fire whoever he or she wants for any reason, even if that person is investigating the president's own wrongdoing. And so Congress passes this kind of anti-Wilsonian law that relies actually on a case from the time of Franklin Roosevelt, where the court did say, actually, Congress can create protections for civil servants that even a president can't undo, and especially in positions where it's essential that there be a kind of independence. And the Supreme Court upholds this law, the independent prosecutor law. Now, it's since expired, and we're back to the system of that Nixon was in. And frankly, there is no protection for this investigation under our Constitution. My belief is that if the president wants to fire his attorney general, who refused to fire Mr. Mueller, that constitutionally that actually probably is prohibited, probably allowed You know, we're in a sort of position where the imperial presidency has no direct legal oversight. And that does trace a sort of origin to this more, more benign argument about this kind of inconsequential postmaster general.
Surely the safeguard against a president doing that actually is politics, isn't it? Right here and now, it would be catastrophically a move of gross incompetence for this president, and I use him just purely as an example, to get rid of Robert Mueller. So I suppose my question is, do we really need a law, an act, when you have political common sense as a backstop?
Right. And, that's what the defenders of the current system say. And they say Congress, after all, can exercise its oversight powers as well. But my worry is that, politics depends on the moment. And I don't know where we are, frankly, politically at this moment. Could the president of the United States, with a new attorney general confirmed by the Senate, I mean, when that happens, who's respected because of his role in the Bush administration, replay the Saturday night massacre in a way that actually has a completely different result, namely that the current president gets away with the firing and faces no consequences? I'm just not sure. I mean, what really ultimately stopped Nixon was the threat of impeachment and a court that was willing to intervene to demand that the subsequent special counsel be allowed to subpoena the Watergate tapes. Those all, to me, don't seem like inevitable historical outcomes. And so I'm just not confident that the previous example is the one that would guide us now. And frankly, this president and his allies have said the problem with Nixon was that he was too weak. He didn't fight hard enough. He did step down. And, that lesson, I'm not sure that they're wrong.
So we're starting to get to some of the main kind of tenets of your book. But I suppose the biggie is impeachment and the role that that plays in censoring a president. And I think there's lots of misunderstanding about actually what impeachment is. People think that if a president gets impeached and if he's found guilty, he automatically gets booted out of office, and that's not at all the case.
Correct.
But give us a quick history on impeachment, but then specifically with the views on impeachment, specifically somebody like Frederick Douglass, who was kind of horrified at President Andrew Johnson just after the Civil War and the way that he was treating kind of a recalcitrant South. So what is impeachment, a history of impeachment? Let's just do that first.
Sure.
Do those elements first, and let's just see where the conversation then takes us from there.
Sure. The Constitution sets up a specific system of what Washington called constitutional punishment. That is really political. This isn't a judicial process, and it's not a judicial standard, although it's often misunderstood as one. If a majority of the House of Representatives and decides to vote to impeach, or it's the equivalent of indict, president on specific grounds, that begins and goes to the Senate for a what resembles a trial, but again, it isn't a legal process. If the Senate decides, in considering the charges or the impeachment brought by the House, that two-thirds of senators decide that the charges are warranted, a two-thirds vote results in the removal of a president from office and the end, really, of that presidency. And the Constitution explains what the standard is supposed to be. Both the House and the Senate are supposed to ask the question of whether or not the sitting president of the United States has committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, that sounds like a legal standard, so why did I say it's not a legal process? There is no thing in the criminal law that's no category of the criminal law that's called high crime.
It's meant to convey, I think, a different idea, that phrase, which is really a violation of the terms of office, the violation of the oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. But the history of impeachment is sort of a back and forth between what I've just said and a more legalistic way of seeing it. So President Johnson, and this follows on our discussion about hiring and firing, disregarded a requirement at the time that said that he had to, that he couldn't on his own just fire his Secretary of War. He wants to fire the Secretary of War, a holdover from the Lincoln administration, and just does it without consulting the Senate. Now, impeachment charges are brought against him, largely focusing on that act and why it's illegal, and he's disregarded the letter of the law by engaging in this firing. But Frederick Douglass at the time, the orator, the abolitionist, the civil rights advocate, makes what I think is an important correction to the way that the Senate and the House are conducting this investigation. And the correction is this. He says, let's call Johnson out for an impeachable offense that is actually common sense. Namely, he's an opponent of the end of slavery. He's failing to enforce the 13th Amendment. He's traveling around the country making vile, racist speeches. And that's the reason why he should be impeached and removed from office. Nothing to do, really, with this Secretary of War firing. And what I say in the book, you know, first of all, given what we just were saying about Wilson, it might be in retrospect that the firing by a cabinet official, by the president, is constitutional under the Myers precedent. That case, of course, hadn't been decided at the time, but he might have been within his rights to do it. I think he probably was. So I'm actually taken with the Frederick Douglass argument that this isn't a legal process. Let's not pretend it is. Let's call it what it is and say that this president, speaking at least in his time, President Johnson, has disregarded the oath. And it's the racism and the failure to end slavery, to faithfully execute the laws, like Washington says, a failure of the oath that warrants his impeachment.
Is it a failure of the oath, or is it the failure to uphold the mores of the time? Because, you know, it seems to me that this is a movable standard, really. And there is something to be said for objectively saying you cannot do this, you cannot do that, and that's just written in some kind of tablet of stone, and then if that's transgressed. But to say that somebody has exhibited some behavior of which people at the time do not like, well, we all know that, you know, habits and mores change over time.
I think he's saying something in between. I don't think it's simply that he's an immoral president. And so, you know, the president might be drinking a lot, for instance, and some people might find that immoral. That's not an impeachable offense.
We're talking about Ulysses Grant now.
Right. There are many presidents. So I don't think that's what I know that's not what he's saying. And he's also not saying, let's look at the letter of the law. He did something illegal here. I think what he's saying, the in-between position is, you know, there are very specific things under the oath of office that the president is supposed to do. And one of them is to faithfully execute the law. And it isn't just that it's immoral to bring back slavery. It's that the 13th Amendment, which after all, they had just fought a war to enact, basically, and had gone through the process of amendment, very difficult process. Lincoln doesn't just rely on the Emancipation Proclamation or an executive order. He goes and seeks the constitutional process. And then for this president to come in and really just sort of not only failed to, you know, stop ongoing slavery, but to sort of speak in this deeply racist way against the ideas of anti-subordination that had just been enshrined into law, that's a constitutional violation. Now, can he go to jail for failing to execute the law? No, it's not a criminal offense. But it's not just a moral one either. It's that there is a failure in the duties of office. That to me is Douglass's point. And, you know, as you know, I agree with it. And that's why I put the oath central and want to put it back into the way that we evaluate historical presidents.
Why do you think we get so excited about impeachment, the threat of impeachment, possible impeachment, the whiff of impeachment? Because ultimately, all it is a slap on the wrist at best.
Well, it's the end of a presidency. I think in a way it's more parliamentary. I'd like to, I guess what I'm recommending is it's not quite a no confidence vote, but as your no confidence votes were being considered in regard to Theresa May's continuing as prime minister, I thought, you know, these are very different processes in some ways, but in some ways, what Douglas is saying, let's not make it as big a deal as it is. Let's not pretend it's a criminal offense. Let's say it's a failure of this leader to do the job. I think maybe because I don't know why it's seen as a bigger deal than that, but it's probably the term high crime suggests that there's a condemnation of this president, not just an end of their presidency. But I think what Douglas is really saying is, look, you know, this is a job that has to be done. And if you really fail in it in the way that this Johnson has, we need to end this presidency.
Corey, it's been fascinating to speak to you and to go through some of the important parts of how the office has evolved. The book is called The Oath and the Office. How long did it take you to write it?
I'd say a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I have to date it, but I wrote a piece during the campaign when Donald Trump was running, basically called Trump versus the Constitution, outlining why at least candidate Trump's proposals in many ways violated the Constitution. And my thought was, you know, this can't just be about one president. We have to reflect on the nature of the office and think more generally, historically, and return to that Washingtonian idea that the primary thing that matters for a president is whether or not they're willing to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And so, that prompted this much more historical inquiry.
Here's a question which I think is probably somewhat childlike on my part, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It might not make the edit if you just say that's a totally ridiculous question.
That's usually the best one.
And you shame me. if I'm going to promise to uphold the Constitution, how can I sign into law any amendment to it?
It's a very good question, actually, and that the answer is that the amendment process is part of the content of the Constitution. And what it says is, I think it would be a violation of a president to say, you know what, as Johnson did, I don't like this 13th Amendment thing. I want to go back to the pre-Civil War Constitution. That you can't do. But the Constitution is very clear that if there's something in it that you want to change, that, you know, that's open to do. And the history of American democracy is often the history of using that amendment process to change the law. So the income tax is one example, or the expansion of the suffrage. And the framers believed they weren't perfect. They were not infallible. And they trusted future supermajorities, at least, to amend even the most basic parts of our Constitution. Now, there are some parts that there's one part in particular that you can't amend, and that's the requirement that the Senate be made up of two members from each state. So there's one limit. But aside from that, the framers trusted us to use that process. So I think a president who pushes for an amendment, as we talked about, for instance, Wilson and the suffrage, that is certainly within the bounds of the office.
So I've been speaking to Corey Brett Schneider, who's written the book The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Corey, thank you for coming on and explaining how the office has evolved and how the oath has been a central part in keeping them to account to the American people.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and what great questions. And I love delving deeply into that history.